Okay, so the idea of this toy is that there's a magnet hanging here, a bunch of magnets here, and a bunch of magnets there, attracting it. And there's a valuable prize if you balance it in the middle. Don almost got it. Others can try later if they want to. You get an A if you can do it. Okay. It's no fun. You can't make it drag or something on the bottom, right? It has to be hanging there. Okay, so you got very close, right?
Really close.
Fairly close, yeah. Okay, so lecture two is about force laws and Lewis structures, and if we go quickly, we may at the end get to resonance. Congratulations to the people from Saybrook. They're the first people to get their list together so they can find each other on the wiki. That one's complete. The others aren't. Some haven't even started. So remember, you're going to get together in groups to do problems for Monday. Okay, so here's a big question. Are there atoms and molecules? And what question are you going to ask about that if somebody gives you an answer? That's what we'll ask, but that's not the main. What's the main question? How do you know, right? And so we'll get on to that. But also, what force holds the atoms together? So, what holds atoms together? Well, the Greeks thought it was hooks, right? But we are more modern than that now. So, clips. Like here's some models, and they have these little clips in them there. And if you put them together, you have to press very hard, and it really holds them tight. In fact, it holds them so tight that you have to use this tool to get them apart again. So clips are pretty good for holding atoms together, right? Or friction, like this model here, right? There are no clips, but these things are they're held together by friction. Okay, so that could be it with sticks or maybe strings or something. Or maybe springs, because they can bend and so on. Or bolts. This is a drawing from a model made in the 19th century, which was held together with bolts. Or hormones could hold them together. Or maybe the hands of the deity hold them together, right? Now, how many people, if we were to vote on these, how many people would vote for these? I don't see any votes. Okay, so here's some other possibilities. So, these are all things you've heard of one place or another. And let's vote. So, there might not be just one thing that holds them together. There might be two or three. Okay? So, we got here a ballot, and I'm going to go through these, and I'm going to look at you and say roughly what fraction of the class thinks that each of these things is important in holding atoms together in bonds. You've taken AP chemistry, right? Okay, so you must know this. Okay, gravity?
No.
Anybody? No. Don't let your friends fool you. It may be gravity. Okay, so zero there. Electrical forces. How many don't think electrical forces? Okay, so that's unanimous. Magnetic forces. Nobody for magnetic? Only two? Can't sell any more than that. Three? Four? Hold them up higher so I can see. Oh, we're getting more. Magnetic forces important in holding bonds together? I'd say there are roughly 10 votes for that. Okay, kinetic energy. Is that important in holding things together? How many people think kinetic energy is important in holding things together? Hold them up so I can see roughly. I got about five votes there. Quantum forces. Okay, I'm guessing about 20 there. Of course, we don't really know what quantum forces are, right? But we may have heard that word. How about shared electron pairs? Anybody don't think that? It looks unanimous. Is there anything that doesn't? One, two, three, four, 5, 6 bonds, holding atoms together in bonds. What holds? That's our problem in organic chemistry, right? We're not so interested in isolated atoms. That's physics. We're interested in bonds coming together and holding together. Okay, how many think shared electron pairs are important for that? How many don't? Anybody? One? All but one. Okay, how about quarks? Are they important in making bonds? Right? Are quarks important in making bonds? No. The strong force. Have you heard of the strong force? It's one of the fundamental forces of nature. How many people think? I'd say 5. The weak force. Have you heard of the weak force? That's one of the fundamental forces in physics. Let's see, hold them up so high enough I can see. About 7, maybe. Strange attractors holding things together. I think we're up to a dozen there, maybe. Exchange of photons. Exchange of photons. 1. Do I hear 2? 2. 3. 3. Exchange of virtual particles. 5. Okay, so we'll revisit this a couple weeks from now, okay? After we've thought some more about this problem. Okay. So, back to the very first chemist on the front of the building, Robert Boyle, 1627 to 1691. The reason he's there is he wrote this important book, The Skeptical Chemist. Have you heard about that? It's in 1661, if you translate down at the bottom. The Skeptical Chemist, or Chemico-Physical Doubts and Paradoxes Touching the Spagyrist Principles. So what this book is pointing out all the logical weaknesses, and especially experimental weaknesses, right? That there are hardly any experiments in Aristotelian, the very old-fashioned stuff, but also in the stuff that comes from alchemists, led by Paracelsus, for the last 150 years. By the time he writes this, right? And he shows that this stuff essentially is nonsense, but he doesn't show where you go from here, except that you need to do experiments, because he's a follower of Bacon. In fact, he's one of the founders of the Royal Society, one of the original founders. And the next year, in 1662, he published this famous book, New Experiments Physico-Mechanical, Touching the Spring of Air. So remember, we said one thing that might be holding together is springs, holding atoms together. But he tested this, the spring of the air, and found that P times V is a constant, Boyle's law, using a pneumatical engine, an air pump. And the air pump was built by his servant, Robert Hooke. And this is a picture of Hooke's air pump. We'll talk more about Hooke later on. And Hooke then, in 1678, published this book, Lectures de Potentia Restitutiva, or of Spring. And we're fortunate to have a copy of this book here. Right. And if we turn the page, we find a figure. Okay, so maybe so you can see it a little easier here. He begins, "The theory of springs, though attempted by diverse eminent mathematicians of this age, has hitherto not been published by any. It is now about 18 years since I first found it out, but designing to apply it to some particular use, I omitted the publishing thereof." He didn't publish it because he had an invention in mind. Do you know what the invention was? To make a clock that would be accurate for navigation. Okay. About 3 years since, His Majesty was pleased to see the experiment that made out this theory tried at Whitehall, and also my spring watch. So the king actually saw this watch. Okay. About 2 years ago, since I printed this theory in an anagram, at the end of my book on the description of helioscopes, that is CEIIINOSSSTTUU. What the heck does that mean? Why do you do that? Yeah.
Prove that it was his idea first, but he didn't want anybody to steal it?
Exactly. But he could go back and point out that if you unscramble this anagram, it shows that he understood it. And now he reveals it in this book. He says, ut tensio sic vis. That is, the power of any spring, the force of the spring, we'd say, is in the same proportion with the tension. That's the extension thereof. So the more you stretch, the more it pulls, and it's a direct proportion. So that's Hooke's law, the force law. The force is proportional to the displacement with our force constant. And this is that figure that you see there. And here he's got the plot. There's how much you're extending the spring. Ut tensio, sic vis. So the force. Right? So you make a plot and it's a straight line. It's directly proportional to the extension. And if you were to plot the energy, which he does here, right? Then it's a parabola. It's proportional to x squared. That's when you integrate x, you get x squared, right? Okay, so that's Hooke's law. Now, Hooke and Newton were always at loggerheads with one another. We talked about this book last time, but the main point in Newton, or the inspiration for Newton, was to explain the motion of the heavenly bodies, and the idea that you could have force between things without having string or springs or bolts or something like that holding together, that the action went through space at a distance somehow. Now, it's not necessarily so that gravity works that way. In fact, Descartes had a different idea that was blocked repulsion. That is, you have particles whipping around in the universe and they're bombarding the heavenly bodies like the moon from all directions. But since they're coming from all directions, they balance out and you don't have anything. Net, right? But if the Earth's in the way, it'll block some of them. And then there's a net force on the moon in the direction of the Earth. Right? This was Descartes' idea. Newton said the force is proportional to the inverse square of the distance. An inverse square force law for gravity. Is that consistent with Descartes' model? If you pulled the Earth back to a greater distance, it would block fewer of the things that are going to hit the moon, right? Should it be proportional to the square is the important thing, inverse square. So you can think about that. That's a fun problem to think about. And how about the mass? Remember, gravitation has to do with the masses, too. How does that work out? So anyhow, we're not going to spend time going into this. You do this in the physics class. Professor Shankar talks about this there. But I just wanted to show you that here's an inverse square force law, which is gravity. Okay, but then there was a subsequent book, which was published first in 1704. This is the second edition, which was published in 1717. The work he did this about was in 1660s. But he didn't publish it until 1704 because he didn't want to publish it while Hooke was still alive. Hooke died in 1703 because he had very much criticized some of Newton's experiments before and theories. So he wanted to wait till Hooke was out of the way. But anyhow, then in the second edition in 1717, he actually talked about chemistry, even though the title of the book is about optics. And he did it by putting questions at the end. Remember these Bacon's ideas was that you don't deal with hypotheses. Okay? But instead of hypotheses, you could ask questions. Okay? So these are queries. So the 31st query at the end of optics is in fact about chemistry. He says, have not the small particles of bodies certain powers, virtues, or forces by which they act at a distance, not only on rays of light, to reflect, refract, and inflect them, but also upon one another for producing a great part of the phenomena of nature. For it's well known that bodies act upon one another by the attractions of gravity, magnetism, electricity, and these instances show the tenor and course of nature and make it not improbable, but that there may be more attractive powers than these. For nature is very consonant and conformable to itself. So there are patterns in nature. So like gravity, like magnetism, like electricity, there may be some other force like that which holds these particles together very strongly. How these attractions may be performed, that is the mechanism by which they're performed, I do not here consider. What I call attraction may be performed by impulse. Where do you get that idea that it might be impulse that's causing attraction? Yeah. That's that Descartes theory, right? Things bombarding in your shadow and then there's a net force. Maybe by impulse or by some other means unknown to me. I use that word here to signify only in general any force by which bodies tend toward one another, whatsoever be the cause. For we must learn from the phenomena of nature what bodies attract one another and what are the laws. Like gravity is an inverse square law. What are the laws and properties of attraction before we inquire the cause by which the attraction is performed? So don't worry about the mechanism. First try to get the distance dependence or the mass dependence and so on. The attractions of gravity, magnetism, electricity react to very sensible distances, ones that you can feel, right? And so have been observed by vulgar, that is, common eyes. Anybody can observe that. And there may be others which reach to so small distances as hitherto to escape observation. And perhaps electrical attraction may reach to such small distances even without being excited by friction. So friction generates static electricity and things attract one another. But there may be something like that that works at really, 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 really small scale. Okay. So we must learn from the phenomena of nature what bodies attract one another and what are the laws. So that's what Newton's going after, is the laws, not the mechanism, because this is, he's just talking about action at a distance. He's not talking about mechanism. The parts of all homogeneal hard bodies which fully touch one another stick together very strongly. Do you ever see something that when it touches one another they stick very strongly? Not magnets or something, but just regular old stuff. What? Microscope slides. Do you ever try to get microscope slides apart? Okay. And for explaining how this may be, some have invented hooked atoms, which is begging the question, and others tell us that the bodies are glued together by rest, that is, by an occult quantity, quality. And that's what the alchemists, and in fact Boyle too alluded to that. Or rather by nothing. And others that they stick together by conspiring motions, that is by relative rest among themselves. I had rather infer from their cohesion that their particles attract one another by some force, which in immediate contact is exceeding strong. At small distances performs the chemical operations above mentioned and reaches not far from the particles with any sensible effect. So some strong force which is really, really strong when it's close and then gets much weaker when they're further apart. So maybe that's what's holding atoms together. Okay, so maybe the chemical force is even greater than 2 as the exponent in the denominator. Maybe it changes really fast. Okay. And he continues, the attraction between glass plates separated by a thin film of oil of oranges may be proportionally greater and continue to increase the closer they get together until the thickness do not exceed that of a single particle of oil, a single molecule of oil. How could he possibly talk about distances of a single molecule of oil? We'll talk about that a little later. There are therefore agents in nature able to make the particles of bodies stick together by very strong attractions, and it is the business of experimental philosophy, that is science, to find them out. That's what we should look for, and that's what we're looking for in this course, is what holds these things together. Okay, and the business will take us about 5 weeks before we really understand what holds atoms together in bonds. So we have the law of gravity, the mass over the square of the distance. Where did we get that law? How do we know that it's 2 in the denominator? Yeah. What experiment? Who did experiments to show that?
Kepler.
Kepler, right? He found Kepler's three laws about how planets moved. And then Newton was able to do the math to show that that was exactly two. And there's questions still about whether it's exactly two. And people are doing all sorts of fancy experiments right now to try to find out if it's like in the 18th decimal place. Or not, actually, it's not that. Gravity isn't known that well. I think it's I forget exactly what it is. But anyhow, to find out whether it really is truly exactly two. Okay, so that came from astronomy, from Kepler, Newton, and then the electrical force. What's the law for how does electrical charges? What's the distance dependence? Anybody know? That's also R squared. It's the product of the charges over R2. How do you know it's two? Exactly two. So who did this? How do you know it's two? How do you know you have that law? Kepler did the stuff for the first one, yeah? Coulomb. Okay, so here's Charles Augustin Coulomb. So he looks like someone from American history to me, a little bit. He looks a little like Washington, and he's almost exactly contemporary with Washington, right? Look at their dates. Okay, so that's the period. He's French, though, of course. He initially wanted to be a mathematician, but his mother had other ideas. He continued to deny his mother's desire that he study medicine and was therefore temporarily disowned. Without funds, he was forced to join his father in Montpellier. And while he was there, he decided to become an engineer if he couldn't become a mathematician. So he went to the National School, Engineering School at Mézières, and then joined the Royal Corps of Engineers, where he served for 30 years. And he in fact was the principal engineer in building this, and it took him 8 years to build that. And during that time, he got all sorts of, in Martinique, he got all sorts of tropical diseases, which made him infirm the rest of his life. But when he got back to France, he joined the Royal Academy of Sciences, but only for 12 years. It ended in 1793. Anyone know why? Yeah. The French Revolution. There was no longer a Royal Academy of Sciences as of 1793. But they reestablished the Institut de France in 1795, and he was a member of that until his death. So here's his formal portrait, and we'll show a number of these portraits as we go along, and almost always the people are holding something that's very important in their scientific life, and he's holding this thing, which is an electrical torsional balance from 1785 that he built in 1785, and that's his diagram of it. Now, there's hanging down that tall column, it's about, you can see it's a foot and a half or 2 feet high, there's a fine silver wire, a quarter as thick as your hair, right? About 20 microns thick. And it's suspending this pointer here. And at this end of the pointer, there's a little pith ball that's coated with gold, right? And there's another ball coated with, and that whole thing, of course, fits down here. And there's another bigger ball coated with gold here. And so what he does is take this pinhead and charge it by static electricity by rubbing, and then he touches it to that, and the charge goes on both those two balls. And then what happens when they get a charge? Both get the positive charge, right? What will they do? They repel one another. So will they go to infinity? No, because when they displace, they twist the wire, right? And he had previously shown that the force on a twisted wire is Hooke's law. The force is proportional to the amount of displacement, to the angular displacement. Right? So he could measure very, very weak forces with this. Okay, and then at the top he had this pointer here, and he could turn the pointer to twist the wire, and if he twists it in that direction, clockwise, what will happen? If he twists the wire after it's gone back to the point shown there, and now he twists it at the top, and he can measure how much it twists on this scale here as this pointer goes around. And what will happen as he twists the wire? Hila? It'll force them toward one another, at least this, depending on how much force you can exert with that twisting that really, really fine wire. So he twisted a certain amount, and then he has a scale here, and he can put his eye here and sight along the pointer and see just how many degrees it's come back. Okay? And he knows, he's already studied the wire. He knows how much force you get from a certain amount of twisting. So he can measure the force between the charges at whatever distance that is. Okay, so in this paper, which you can find on our website, a translation of it, he says this is how much he twists the pointer at the top. Zero, that's at the start, or 120 degrees as shown here, or 567 degrees. He can crank it around several times. And when he does this, this is how many degrees this thing is displaced from the center of that ball. Okay? So he takes this data and he figures out that exponent, that it's 2. And what I want you to do for problems for Wednesday is to use that data and figure out how well he knew that this was 2 and not a little bit larger or a little bit smaller than 2. Right? And in fact, modern experiments that have to do with, curiously enough, with the rest mass of the photon and whether space is three-dimensional, show that delta is less than 10 to the minus 17th. It really is close to 2. Okay? And here's a hint, and there's another hint. So you'll have to figure out what that hint has to do with solving the problem. And then a second problem, that this of course was repulsion. They both had a positive charge. If one was positive and one was negative, he can't do this experiment. He has to devise a different way of doing it. And I want you to figure out why he can't do it by just turning the wire the other way. Right? Crank it the other way to hold them together instead of their being pushed apart. To hold them apart rather than letting them be pushed together. Whereas here you're forcing them together when they want to be apart. Why can't you do it for attraction? Okay, so those are problems for Wednesday. And again, get together, use the wiki to find out who's in your college, divide up into 2 teams within your college or set of colleges, and you can turn in your answers together. Okay, so let's look at the magnitude of binding energies from various sources. This relates to what the vote we took earlier on. Okay, so Coulomb is the product of the charges over the distance. Now, that notice this is not force, because it's not R squared. It's energy. This is how much energy you have. Or magnetic, or the strong force, or gravitational force, or the chemical bond. And here's a logarithmic scale of the potential energy measured in organic chemists' units of kilocalories per mole. And now, so if we have a proton and an electron at the distance of a carbon-carbon bond, 1.5 angstroms, it turns out that their energy is 216 kilocalories per mole relative to being infinitely separated. They lower their energy by this much as they come together. Okay, so in the middle of this scale. The magnetic energy for 2 electron spins at the same distance is 5 orders of magnitude smaller. Okay? The strong binding force that holds a proton and a neutron together in a deuterium nucleus is 5 orders of magnitude bigger. Okay? Gravity is 10 to the minus 32, so it's out of... Don't worry, we don't have to worry about gravity. Fortunately, nobody voted for it. Okay. Now, how big is a chemical bond? A carbon-carbon bond is 90 kilocalories per mole. So what plausibility do you see from this? It's remarkably close to electrical charges in its order of magnitude. One's 10 to the fifth bigger, one's 10 to the fifth smaller. But this is about, has the right flavor. Doesn't prove anything. But anyhow, it looks like it might have something to do with Coulombic energy, which we just talked about, Coulomb's law. And this 10 to the fifth, incidentally, will come back to revisit in a completely different context later, as you'll see when we talk about X-ray diffraction. Okay, so it's similar to Coulombic interaction for an electrical charge, but we didn't mention anything about kinetic energy here. Not many people voted. How many voted for? Only 5 people voted for kinetic energy, so maybe that we don't need to put it there. We'll see later on. Okay, so but there's a fundamental question. Is there a chemical force law, 1 over R to the something or other, that talks about bonds or whatever it is, or proportional to R, like Hooke's law? Okay, so here's a way of looking at this. Suppose you had three atoms bound together by single bonds, and you could put rods on the outer atoms and pull them apart. Right? It would begin to stretch, and at some point it would pop. And the question is, how far can you stretch it before it pops? That this is a way of measuring. If we could do this experiment, we'd measure the force law, right? Okay, so there it goes, further, pop. Okay, so how far do you go before you pop with a chemical bond is the question. Okay? So here's where this demonstration with magnets came in. And I think we broke it, did we?
Yeah.
Let's see, we can put it up just a little higher. So anyhow, you've already seen this. We won't belabor it. Okay. So you can't do it. Don can't get his A that way by balancing it. It just doesn't work. Now, that's too bad. Actually, here's some tape. I forget your name.
Matt.
Okay, Matt. Here, what you can do is tape this on here, right? And then you can try to get your A.
Okay.
Because in the meantime, everyone else, and in fact Matt himself, remember you get this valuable prize. I thought I had something else in here. Okay, let me talk a little more. In fact, Matt, you can sit down if you want. Well, you could get it off the web later. You can keep working now. You might get your, if you get your A this way, it's ever so much easier than doing all the rest of the stuff in the course. Okay. I've got a slide out of order here, and what I was going to do while Matt is trying to earn his A is to get pictures of the class. So we had, like we had of Connie. So we'll need a little more light here. Okay. So you're supposed to smile. There's a slide that says smile later on. But let's see, I want to do this. There. Okay, so look here. Smile here. I'll get you while you're doing it here. And you people in the back are too far back. Some of you I know. Better the first year. All there. Let's see if I can get you all in here. One last group. Save the best for the last year. Okay, we'll see. Did you do it?
Oh, yeah.
Huh? You done it?
Yeah.
I missed it. No, it has to stay. Okay. So now we can look at why we have this problem. Okay, so suppose we have Hooke's Law. Let's see that. There we go. Okay, so there's the parabola, Hooke's law. Okay, and we call zero when the spring is neither stretched nor compressed. Okay, but now as we go out, the slope of this is the force. So as we go out, the force increases. Obviously. Okay. Now, if we had electrical charges or gravity or something like that, it would be different. Because now the force is inverse rather than direct in the distance or the displacement of the thing. Right, so it looks like that. Right, and now as you go further away, the force gets weaker, the restoring force, rather than stronger, obviously. Now, suppose you had this particle between two particles, so it's being pulled both ways, one way by one spring and one way by the other. So this is the position of that one particle. Here it's at its normal position relative to the particle on the left. Here it's at normal position relative to the particle on the right, but they're both stretched a little bit, right? So it's feeling both of these forces. Now there's some place in the middle where those two slopes are exactly the same, even if the springs are different. Right? There's some place where the slopes counteract one another and you have zero net slope, no force. Right? So if we add those two things together, right, the sum of those two curves is that, with this being zero down here. There's the sum of these two. So there's a particular position right here where the particle in the middle will just sit there. Okay, it can vibrate around that point, move back and forth. Now let's try the same thing. So that's a balanced minimum, the same force in both directions. Okay. Now let's try it this way with another charge or gravitational thing on the other side of our particle. So now, there's, say it's gravitation, there's something on this side of our particle, and we're trying to balance in the middle. Or more relevant for getting your A, there's a magnet suspended in the middle and they're attracting magnets here and here. Okay? Now, here, there's a place where the forces exactly cancel. But if you add those two curves together, taking zero up at the top for infinite separation, you get that. So that's not a balanced minimum, it's a double minimum. That's a single minimum, that's a double minimum, and what you guys were trying to do was to balance something on the head of a pin, which is impossible. Okay? So it can't be done with one of these kinds, with these inverse force laws, you can't do it. Because the closer one dominates, the closer one dominates, so it'll always get sucked to the closer one. Okay, now, thus with springs, you might be able to make a stable polyatomic atom from point atoms. If you had atoms connected by springs, then you could have a structure. But if you have atoms connected by electrical force, it can't be stable. They'll either fly apart or collapse together. You can't have it. You can't do it with ions, and you can't do it with magnets to get a stable structure. However, If we were right that it was springs, if they obeyed Hooke's law, then they would never break. Right? It would get stronger and stronger and stronger force until they come back. And in fact, quarks seem to do that kind of thing, amazingly enough. So what you need is something like the Morse potential, which you guys have seen. It must be that the force looks something like that. What in the world was that? Oh, okay, good. Anyhow, the Morse potential looks something like that. So there's nothing fundamental about the Morse potential. That was just cobbled together to make mathematics easy by a professor at Princeton in 1929. Right? The attraction must look something like that. So here's a fixed neighbor, right? And if you stretch that other one, the energy goes up. And here's a second neighbor, and if you stretch it by moving the center one to the right, the energy goes up. And if you add those two together, you get this, and you have something that's stable in the middle, okay, like Hooke's law was. Okay, now if you start stretching this chain of three atoms, ultimately you know it's going to pop. So look what happens. We're moving them further and further apart, and now it popped. Right? There's a barrier in the middle. This thing is either going to sit here, or if you push it up to here, it'll flop down here. It won't stay in the middle anymore. Right? Now, here's the question. There's where it's just transitioning from being a single minimum to being a double minimum. Just when it's ready to pop. How can you look at these curves and tell when that point is? That's what we were trying to tell. When will it pop? Can you see how you tell? See, as we move these outer ones apart, we move these curves, the Morse potentials, away from each other. At what point does it pop? Yeah? At the inflection points, right? When it changes from being Hooke's law kind of thing, a direct force increasing with distance, to being one that where the force decreases with distance. When that curvature changes from being positive to being negative, when you get these two things far enough apart that the inflection point is there, then it pops. Okay, so now we've done Newton's kind of thing. What's the form of the law? But what are the bonds? Right? He said that's the secondary question. First, you get the force law. So what are bonds? Well, in the 19th century, experiments that we'll talk about later on in the course, after we've understood what bonds really are, but anyhow, experiments led to the idea of valence numbers, and these are structures drawn in 1861, and you see some atoms have one hook, some two, some three, some four kind of thing. So it was different valence for different atoms, H1, C4, O2, N3. But why don't they all have the same number of valences? Why are they different? Okay. Now, the funny thing is that nitrogen is sometimes 3 and sometimes 5. How do you figure that? Because you have NH3, but you also have NH4Cl. So here it's bound to 3 atoms, here it's bound to 5 atoms. How in the world can you do that? Well, Gertrude and Robert Robinson got the Nobel Prize in chemistry and was one of the great organic chemists of the 20th century. In 1917, they published a paper that had this figure in it involving nitrogen. What's this loop? Pardon me? Electron cloud. No. Because this is 1917. Right? Nobody knew from electron clouds at the, or almost nobody knew from electron clouds, and certainly organic chemists didn't know from electron clouds. What they were showing was how you explain the reactivity of ammonia. Right? So the idea was, this is their text, it may reasonably be assumed that the partial dissociation is a stage in the complete process. So this was a theory of partial dissociation, that this is in fact a bond of nitrogen to itself. And it begins to weaken, and as it weakens, it gains the ability to form two new bonds. That is, these bonds to themselves are going to become bonds to other atoms. Okay? And the same thing can happen to HCl, which had a single bond, but it's beginning to weaken and make new things. So it's partial dissociation. And then they come together, and this meets with that, and this meets with that, and then they form up, and you've got the five bonds to nitrogen. Right? So these things are called latent valencies. Latent is a word, you know what the antonym, the opposite of latent is?
Explicit,
but actually it's patent or patent. Patent is you figure out some way of doing something and you're willing to tell everybody else. So you open it, right? Latent is hidden, okay? Okay, so this is a latent valence loop. Okay, so this is how this reaction occurs then. Okay, that seems plausible enough. Does it explain the trivalence of pentavalent nitrogen? Might partial dissociation explain a mean HCl reactivity? Well, there's a problem here. This is such a slippery concept, it can explain everything and you have no confidence in it. Right? And why? Because you got to ask, why is there a latent valence loop? Which atoms have latent valence groups? When do they partially or why do they partially dissociate? And how many valence loops do you have? Because you could have every atom has 3,800 valence loops. Right? And they could be used or not used. So you could have any valence you want. Why does it have these loops? How many does an atom have? Right? Nothing about that in this theory. But the electron was discovered in 1897. And G.N. Lewis had the idea of the cubic octet. So you've heard of Lewis, G.N. Lewis, Lewis shared pairs. Okay, this is him as a Harvard undergraduate in 1894. And here he is 8 years later as an instructor at Harvard. And this is a page of his notes when he gave lectures there in 1902. And he was explaining the periodic table over there, right? So lithium has one valence electron, and beryllium, magnesium have two, and boron, aluminum have three, and so on, arranged at the corners of a cube, right? Or you can have a cube inside a cube. right? That's sort of like shells. Okay, now let's see how you could use this to predict share pair bonding. So you have two chlorine atoms, each of which has a hole in their octet, in their cubic octet. What do you do to make a chlorine-chlorine bond? Yeah? Push them together. Right? And now they both have cubes. Okay? Or if you took oxygen, what would they share? Here they share an edge. What could you do with oxygen? Henry? Share a face. Okay. Okay, so we're on a roll. Here's nitrogen. What do we share? You can't do it with nitrogen. Okay. So so he had another idea. This was a cubic octet, right? This is nitrogen, cubic octet. So instead of having them at the corners of a cube, pull them together along these edges to make pairs at the corners of a tetrahedron. Okay? So a tetrahedral instead of a cubic octet. And now you bring two of those together and you complete it. So the tetrahedral octet was where cubic octet... It started with a cube, but it had to go to a tetrahedron to do this. So the tetrahedral distribution of the bonds from carbon had already been known for 40 years in organic chemistry. Lewis wasn't inventing it. It wasn't showing something that was a surprise to the organic chemists. Now, a good theory should be realistic and simple. At least as simple as possible. Okay? So in regard to facts, it should allow prediction of what happens when you mix things, okay? Or if it doesn't quite reach that level, at least it could suggest fruitful new experiments, even if you're not quite sure how they'll come out. Still useful. Or it could explain things that you've already observed. Or it could just serve to classify things and remembering them, even though it doesn't do any of these other things. Right? So this is a hierarchy of virtues of a theory. But that last two are not prediction, they're postdiction. And that's the realm of lore, where a lot of chemistry still resides, and we'll talk about that, but we'll have to talk about it next time because our time's up now. So when you're doing a wiki, you don't have to go further than we got in a lecture that it carries over to the next lecture, and you can wait for that to write your wiki. Okay? I don't see anybody new in here, but if you haven't been placed in the course, you need to be placed in the course. And Sunday, last night, nobody showed up, right? You gave a party and nobody came to Eugene's discussion section. It's on the syllabus and so on, but you guys send an email, okay? So the peer tutors will lead a session on Sunday. It'll help you do it's on the schedule. Yeah.
Hi. I went on the wiki site and looked for my name on one of the assignments. I must have tried it.
Oh, it's not. Maybe it's not there yet.
Oh, okay. So,
yeah. If it's not there, there are only two lectures that have been done, and not everybody's been assigned yet.
Thank you. And when you do assign us, we complete the wiki for the lecture that we've just had, not the lecture that's coming up.
Yeah.
All right.
But it's useful. But you should read ahead and get, because you know what you're going to be doing.
Right. But the wiki that's done is the wiki for the lecture that we've just had, not the lecture that's to come up.
Yeah, the wikis you have to do them within 36 hours of the lecture.
After a wiki, you put two people's names.
Yeah.
Are we supposed to work together? Or?
I think it's nice to work together, but you don't have to. But okay. I think it's better if you do it that way.
Okay, and in the end, we both get credit.
Yeah. Okay. But and if you both... The way I know who's done what is there's a function called history that says who at what time did what corrections, right? Or changes or creation or whatever. And so I look at that. So if two people work together, but only one person entered it, which is usually the case, you have to tell me that you work together so I know to give credit to you both.
If we have technology problems, who should we consult?
They're
IT guys will help.
IT guys, yeah. I don't know exactly what your problem is. Were people able to hear the audio from last lecture?
Actually, what was that?
I think the audio.
Okay, I'm going to put on two different formats this time and see if they'll work. So there'll be two options.
But for the wiki, though, if we do it
together. Did anybody succeed in hearing the audio? I can hear it on my computer.
I don't have a Mac.
But it's supposed to. Well, I'll make a new format for it.
So for the wiki, if we do it together, we just tell you, and then we both get the same grade.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I was a little confused about that.
Yeah.
How do we submit the written assignments, the problem sets?
You can do it either on paper or email it.
To you?
For now, you can email it to me. I'll forward it to the TAs.
And it's jm.mcbride.
J.mcbride.
J.mcbride.
Yeah, it's on the syllabus.
Okay, great. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Professor McBride, I just wanted to tell you that on Mondays and Wednesdays I have a English class from like 9 to 10:15, and so I have to get here in 15 minutes. So
you know, that's fine. I mean, okay. If you're late, it's okay. But it used to be 10 minutes between classes.
Oh man.
It was about 3 years ago they changed it to be 15 minutes between classes.
Yeah, but I just wanted to...
So in the days when men were men and so on, they did that in the snow in 10 minutes. But it's okay to be late.
All right. I've been really enjoying the lectures.
Good. You know, if you can't get a file, let me know, because otherwise I have no way of knowing that it doesn't work, because it works for me. Yeah.
I have one more question. I came from an A-level system.
Pardon me?
I came from a British A-level system.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of organic chemistry.
Already. Yeah.
So should I still take this course, or?
I bet you didn't do this.
Which part?
What we've been talking about.
Oh, no, we didn't do history.
Okay, that's
a bit organic directly.
Yeah, but your organic's different from my organic. You won't be wasting your time.
Oh, yeah. I'm so stuck. I have a meeting right now with Peter Parker, who's the...
Yeah,
US
physics, yeah.
So can you direct me towards his office?
His office, I think, is... I've actually never been to his office. Is it in Sloan Physics, or is it in... Yeah.
He said it's like right across from me.
Yeah, well then you go out the main door.
Yeah.
Just go straight instead of turning to the street.
Okay.
There's a building like this on the...
Yeah.
Facing it.
Okay,
the
thanks.
End there. I wasn't sure where his office was. Pardon me?
The study session things are in fast.
In the library, yeah.
All right, thank you.
But all that stuff is on the web, where things are. If you look at the right place, the syllabus, yeah. Yeah.
I have a fairly similar question as him, on Lee's for lab. I signed up for a Tuesday lab, and my class before that ends at 12:50. And
yeah.
The lab starts at...
Yeah, who you should talk to. See the door that's open across the hall there?
Okay.
That's the person who runs the lab.
Okay.
So I can't tell you anything about that. She's the one that runs it.
All right. Thank you.
Good. Okay. Sorry we didn't get the information out well enough. But from now on, I didn't have an email list until this morning, so you can send emails. Yeah, well, there's not a lot of shopping in this course. It's pretty much people are here are going to be here. Oops. Could you pick this up, please? I dropped that and don't have any hands. If you just put it on here, on the pile. I got it, thanks. Okay, I got it. Thank you. Good. So did you learn something about doing wikis anyhow?
Yeah, I checked it out and I think I got it fully.
People have questions about how do you put a picture in it, how do you make links, how do you make subscripts and superscripts. One thing that we do is to, at the bottom of each page there's a link to the previous and the following one so that you can page through it. Otherwise you have to go back to the index, which is more time consuming.
Yeah.
Because people are going to be studying this as if it were a textbook. So the main page is like a table of contents, but you also want to be able to page through it. Yeah. So tell people to put those links in. And the idea that, you know, some people add extra stuff, which is okay, but the main purpose of it is to be lecture notes that are shared, so that they should try to make what was in the lecture that was unclear clearer.
Yeah, okay,
that's the idea. If they want to, I mean, it's fun if they put something else in, but the reader has to know that they don't have to memorize that for the test.
Yeah.
So they have to put something in there that says this is supplementary or something like that.
What I've been telling them to try to do the most is just like critically analyze what's already there.
Yeah.
Better or...
Yeah, almost always there'll be something that's confusing that a different set of eyes looking at it can figure a way to improve it.
And I think it's useful to know, because critical analysis is like a scientific skill.
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't anywhere near that. So.
Yeah.
So do you need any more help? Or
you can bring that in if you'd like. Thanks.
Where do you want me?
Just put it down. That's okay. Did you try to listen to the audio file?
I didn't.
Yeah,
I think it was just QuickTime, like a.
It's QuickTime, and it works fine on mine. I thought that was pretty general, and it would work on everybody's. But evidently,
I think they just don't have like a QuickTime plugin for Firefox or whatever browser they use.
Yeah, actually, I have to take off. I'm going down to Washington in like 10 minutes. Could you send them an email? What I'm going to do is put today's sound, assuming I have it here, assuming it worked. Yeah, 56, 54, that looks good.